Hot flashes, night sweats, insomnia, irritability, anxiety. Not all women experience these symptoms when they go through menopause, but those that do are the ones we hear about. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, menopause. Human females are the only primates to go through it. I'll talk with evolutionary biologist Anne Bronikowski about how menopause evolved in our species. Then I'll talk about how this change of life came to be considered a medical problem with Judith Hauck, author of Hot and Bothered, Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. And I'll talk about treatments and coping strategies with Dr. Susan Johnson. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about menopause. We'll find out how this change that all women go through if they live long enough came to be considered to be a medical issue. And we'll also talk about symptoms, treatments, and coping strategies for women going through this change of life. But first, human females are the only primates to go through menopause. Anne Bronikowski is an associate professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University, and she recently published a study about this uniquely human experience. Hello, Anne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we know that human females go through menopause, but what gave you the idea to actually look into this in other primates?
So aging in general, and certainly menopause, these are evolutionary puzzles. All right, so in other words, why would traits that are apparently disadvantageous. Why do those kinds of traits evolve? And so a number of primatologists and I worked on a couple of studies involving aging. Menopause occurs in human females around, on average, at about 51 years of age. But this is preceded by two decades of declining fertility. And so what we wanted to ask was, do we see that in other primates? Do we see this declining fertility? And is the rate of declining fertility faster than the rate of increasing death probability? So we're taking sort of an actuarial or demographic approach to understanding a physiological process. So we first were able to model mortality for all of these females in these different primate populations and also a human population. And then we were able to ask, does mortality change in the same way that reproduction is changing? So in other words, is reproduction declining at the same rate as mortality is increasing, or is it actually different? And what we found was that for humans, it's actually happening at a different rate. And of course, this is a well-documented phenomenon. But then what we asked with our unique primate data was, is this also observed in any other primates? And what we found is that no, mortality increases and reproduction decreases are occurring at the same rate.
And the humans that you chose to include in this comparative study, you selected very carefully, right?
Right. So we didn't want to use a so-called westernized or modernized human population with a lot of medical intervention. We were looking for data on a natural fertility, natural mortality population. And there are several good data sets out there. And the data set that we found to be the best data set for this question were on the Kung, which are a sub-Saharan African hunter-gatherer or hunter-forager population.
So you're looking at a group of people who are closer to how we sort of naturally evolved to be without all of the modern interventions.
Exactly. Exactly.
And okay, so help me understand exactly what this means, that our mortality is not increasing at the same rate as our fertility is declining. In a nutshell, that means that once human females go through menopause, they continue to live for an extended period of time.
Right. So we have this extraordinary post-reproductive lifespan for human females. And so we wanted to ask, do we see that post-reproductive lifespan in any other primates? And essentially, 2 to 5% of the lifespan of a non-human primate might be spent in this post-reproductive stage, whereas for humans, 30 to 50% of a human female lifespan is in this post-reproductive stage. And so that's really what our comparative perspective can tell us. Now, I think it's important to note that in the animal kingdom, we see other examples of an elongated post-reproductive lifespan. So some killer whales and, interestingly, gall aphids, Japanese gall aphids, also have this very extensive post-reproductive lifespan. And so this gives us some clues as to potential evolutionary explanations. In all three of these species, we see post-reproductive females enhancing the survival of kin.
So acting as grandmothers and caring for young.
Right. Or mothers and caring for their young, okay. Or helping to care for siblings. Yeah. Some element of relatedness.
Interesting. Now, of course, you can study menopause and compare menopause in humans to other primates. But that question that, of course, everybody wants to know the answer to, which is why do we go through menopause? How can we actually answer that question, or can we ever?
I'm stumbling on that one. It's a tough question. The problem with asking why in a current situation is that we can see how older or infertile, or I guess post-fertile females impact the dynamics of their current society. But we can't necessarily extrapolate to what in evolutionary time would have been important. So we can see a current situation where grandmothers, for example, may actually help with the rearing of grandchildren. But it's hard to reconstruct in our evolutionary past. So really that is the strength of a comparative perspective, because we can't go back in time and ask what were humans doing such that this evolved. We can say, well, what are closely related species doing? And what kinds of phenomena do we see that are in agreement with humans and that are different than in humans?
One of the things that, of course, we think about with menopause and with humans and the other species that go through this decline in reproductive abilities is the investment that they can make in other offspring, whether they're grandchildren or other children. But also, we spend a lot of time and energy investing in our offspring. Did you compare how much time and energy other primates have to spend in rearing their offspring and getting them ready to live independently with humans?
So there's a lot of variation in the energy expenditure that moms have to put out there to successfully wean and fledge their offspring. But it essentially scales with lifespan. I mean, in the sense that a human offspring is not fully independent, until about 13 years of age. Well, a baboon offspring, that may be 5 years of age, but the 5-year-old baboon is like a 13-year-old. Human. So we have looked at that, and there was pretty good agreement among most of these species in the amount of energy that moms have to expend to successfully nurse and then wean their offspring.
So what questions, we can't answer that elusive question why, but what questions are you looking into next? What questions do you want to answer?
So we're interested in some of the physiological hypotheses of menopause and declining fertility. On the one hand, there's this idea out there that there's simply a mammalian shelf life of eggs, right? And so it wouldn't matter how long, whether individuals live to be 100 or 200 years of age, mammalian eggs are only good for 50 years. And after that, it's kind of, you can really think of it as a shelf life. And so, again, a comparative perspective will tell us that's potentially not the case. So it looks like African elephants are reproducing in their 60s, for example. And so then the other sort of explanation is this follicular depletion and hormonal dysregulation of hormonal cycles. And that we can actually test directly by collecting urine or feces samples from individuals and looking at hormonal profiles and how that's changing with age.
Well, that's fascinating. Anne, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure. Thank you.
Anne Bronikowski is an associate professor of ecology, evolution, and organismal biology at Iowa State University. She recently published a study about the fact that human females are the only primates to go through menopause. Now, of course, we've known for a long time that women go through menopause, but how we deal with it, how we think about it, has changed dramatically over the years. With me now is Judith Hauck. She is author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. She's also an associate professor of medical history at the History of Science and Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Hello, Judith.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
So let's go back in time before doctors were called upon when women went through menopause. Do we know a little bit about how women thought about this change of life then?
Before the 20th century, we hardly know anything. Although, sort of, when you look at physicians' writings from, let's say, the 17th century, they don't even generally mention menopause. And that makes some sort of sense if we think about the many reasons why women might stop menstruating. Poor nutrition, breastfeeding. So even the existence of menopause becomes something more predictable, more recognizable, only in the sort of 19th and 20th centuries.
And as it becomes more predictable and recognizable and maybe made it into a little bit of some kind of literature, do we know then what women thought about this?
So again, menopause is not the sort of thing that we have a lot of women writing about.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, I don't know much about what women thought in, let's say, the 19th century about menopause. We just don't know much about it.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break, and then we will move forward in time to when we do know a few more things about it. I'm talking with Judith Hauck. She is the author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. We'll talk about the medicalization of menopause and how things changed over time. And then, of course, we'll jump into modern times. I'll also be talking with Dr. Susan Johnson, an OBGYN, an investigator in a study of women's health across the nation. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well with your questions at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about menopause, and we've talked about research into how menopause evolved in human beings, but now we're going to talk a little bit more about how our thinking about menopause has evolved. My guest is Judith Hauck. She is author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. She's also an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And Judith, I can imagine that at a certain point before birth control, that for some women, menopause was considered to be a welcome change of life because it meant that they would stop having children and a natural change of life as well.
So even now, some women are quite happy to see menopause for the same reason, that they don't have to they can get off the pill, they can stop worrying about birth control more generally. Yeah, so I think both now and certainly before there were reliable forms of birth control, plenty of women were actually quite relieved to see their menstrual cycles going away.
When do we start to see mentions of menopause in medical literature?
We see it starts to become more and more noticed in the 19th century. It's mentioned a little bit before that, but really in the 19th century, it starts to emerge. And when it starts to emerge, only in sort of little mentions, but it's mentioned as sort of a crisis in the 19th century, that this is sort of, it's a tipping point for women. And if women can get through menopause really, if they can get through it all right, then they're going to have decades of good health after. But it's seen as this sort of Rubicon, this crisis that really tosses women around in the 19th century. By the end of the 19th century, physicians start paying more attention to it, and at the same time, they stop saying that it's quite so important, really.
So it stops being quite so frightening.
That's right, absolutely.
What were some of the early treatments, medical treatments, that doctors were using for women crossing this through this crisis period?
Tonics, sort of patent medicines, and a lot of advice. A lot of advice that, well, sort of keep a stiff upper lip and you'll get through it. Now, by the 1890s, we have something new called organotherapy. And that's, we know that menopause has something to do with failing ovaries. And so the idea was that you would give women some sort of ovarian something. So this might be desiccated sheep's ovaries, or by the 1920s, we have some sort of ovarian extracts, but very crude organotherapy, estrogen replacement therapy, if you will, but not quite, begins in the late 19th and then the early 20th century. But physicians largely didn't advise that. They really advised finding useful work. Women physicians often said, why don't you join a suffrage organization? Do something useful so that you can stop dwelling on the fact that you're having hot flashes. That was the most important treatment.
Try to keep your mind off of it.
That's right.
And let's talk about how things progressed then as it became more and more common for doctors to give women different kinds of medical options to help them through menopause. Do you think that was, from your research, being driven by the medical profession, or was that something being driven by women?
It was a combination, certainly. So in the middle period, the middle of the 20th century, for example, there is this revolution in drug therapies. So more and more encounters with medicine end with a prescription. So that becomes commonplace. The drugs that we have to give women, estrogen replacement therapy, become better at doing what we want them to do, relieving vaginal dryness, relieving hot flashes. So, and they're cheaper. So those things combine. And then women still want relief from night sweats, vaginal dryness, all sorts of symptoms of menopause. So they are told about it in the popular literature. They come to their physician saying, can you do something for me? And physicians are really quite reluctant for a long time, again, suggesting, why don't you just keep your mind off it? Or the second line of treatment was often a short course of sedatives. Rather than giving women something that was sort of more systemic, they would just say, all right, I'll give you a short course of sedatives for a couple weeks to help you through these nights that you're not sleeping, or the fact that your son is often at war or you have an adolescent in your house. And then only as a third course of treatment would physicians, at least in the middle of the century, sort of 1950s, 1960s, suggest hormone replacement more generally. So it was a combination of women wanting relief and relief in a drug form being available cheaply.
And hormone replacement therapy did become extremely popular. When did that happen?
Extremely popular happens in the 1960s, really. And it becomes more popular for a variety of reasons. But one of them is in the early 1960s, physicians, a few physicians start asking, should we be thinking about menopause as a disease? Like diabetes, which is an insulin deficiency disease, should we be seeing menopause as an estrogen deficiency disease? And if it's a disease, we shouldn't be waiting until women have symptoms. We should just be treating menopause. Now, this was never an orthodox medical position, but as you might imagine, it caught a lot of popular press, a lot of popular enthusiasm. Women's magazines started asking this question. And because estrogen replacement therapy offered relief not just for hot flashes, but also for things like it helped prevent osteoporosis, heart disease, this became sold to women in women's magazines. So women increasingly demanded it, and physicians increasingly gave in to that. So that's what happened in the 1960s. But even at that sort of peak, most women, there has never been a time in our history yet where most women over 50 have been taking estrogen replacement therapy. So even at its peak, which was in the 1990s, only 34% of women 50 or older ever used hormone replacement therapy. So it seemed like everybody was using it.
Right.
But that's never been the case.
All right. And then, of course, the peak dropped off because we started to have an understanding of some of the negative consequences of hormone replacement therapy.
That's right. So we've had two peaks, really. So in the 1970s, we have a peak because this disease model starts to gain some traction. And then in 1975, we learn that unopposed estrogen, so estrogen without Premarin or progesterone, actually increases the risk of endometrial cancer. So that causes the use of estrogen replacement therapy to decline. But then we start putting progesterone with it, and then it climbs again. And so it's only with the Women's Health Initiative more recently that we again see that the promise of hormone replacement therapy, which was supposed to reduce breast cancer, supposed to reduce risk of heart disease, were in fact not the case, that perhaps it increases our risk of some cancers, that it increases our risk of some kinds of heart disease. So then again, although those results are still now sort of in dispute, that's what again caused this decline.
Do you see a sort of a backlash today against even thinking about menopause in medical terms?
I think there's always been a backlash. I mean, certainly some feminists were saying, really, it's wrong to see a natural event as something pathological and as something undesirable. But plenty of women have always pushed back against this idea that I am somehow diseased. That idea was around. It got a lot of publicity. But I think both in the 80s and 90s and in the 21st century, women have, by and large, said, I want a little bit of relief, but I don't really see that my own body is somehow doing something pathological.
I'm talking with Judith Hauck. She is the author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. And now I want to bring Dr. Susan Johnson into the conversation. She is an OBGYN and an investigator in the study of women's health across the nation. Hello, Dr. Johnson.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Judith, I want you to stay with us as well. And as we talk more about menopause, you're welcome to join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dr. Johnson, as in popular culture, of course, we hear quite a lot about menopause, and we do in different television advertisements for different treatments for menopause. We've heard a lot about the hot flashes and the night sweats. Can you give me an idea of what percentage of the population of women who go through menopause have really serious symptoms that cause them a lot of discomfort?
So the SWAN study, Study of Women's Health Across the Nation, which I'm currently involved with, has added a lot to our understanding of that question, which we didn't really have a lot of information about before. So it looks like most women have at least some hot flashes, but for most women, it's not a big deal and doesn't really cause any real trouble. It might be a bit annoying, but that's about it. Maybe about 10 or 15% of women have none at all. So that's kind of the big picture. Now, there's a spectrum of severity, and I think we can say that, you know, roughly 20% of women have hot flashes and night sweats that are significant enough that they would really prefer to have some kind of treatment. And for a small number of women, they're pretty serious, where they have many hot flashes an hour and can't sleep. So, you know, like many other things, there's a spectrum.
And, of course, we've talked about when this change of life mm-hmm. takes place, and there's a pretty broad spectrum there as well. When typically does this
That's
happen?
That's right. I mean, Judith gave a really nice summary of the history of hormone therapy. And she was correct, of course, that or maybe it was our first speaker, that the average age of menopause is 51 years, roughly. But the age at which the range at which women can experience menopause is quite broad, anywhere normal menopause, if we call it that, from 40 to 60. So that is a huge range. And you can imagine that women who have very early menopause feel differently about it than women who have very late menopause. The other piece of menopause, which our SWAN study is particularly interested in, is the so-called transition from pre to post-menopause. I think at one point in history, probably doctors, at least women never thought this because they knew better, but doctors probably thought of menopause as kind of a light switch on and off. One day you're premenopausal and then you have your last period and then magically you're postmenopausal. But of course, that's not the way it works. This transition takes typically from 5 to 10 years. So women may start having certain symptoms like hot flashes several years before they actually stop having menstrual periods and may continue to have some symptoms for several years after. And how long you stay in that transition is also highly variable.
So
it's very complicated.
Right, different for almost everyone.
Yeah, I think the other quick thing to say about hot flashes that we are sort of confirming in SWAN is that we used to say that hot flashes would be pretty much gone by 5 years after your last period. But it turns out that's not actually true, that there are a pretty substantial number of women who continue to have significant hot flashes much longer than that for many years after that. So
well, and there's a large percentage of our population that has never experienced a hot flash, and there
right.
is a large percentage that never will. Can you describe right. for me what it feels like? Or your best
well,
idea.
Well, let's see here. Right. So typically there's a sudden onset of typically intense heat that may begin in the chest and upper body that may be followed by a cold feeling, actually, as the body shivers to get rid of the heat. And typically they're pretty brief, a few seconds, a few minutes, and then the frequency is quite variable.
Right. So some women can have several in a day.
Yeah, there's actually a change in core body temperature that occurs. I think it's thought that the body has a set point at which below which it shivers and above which it feels heat. And in menopause, the thought is that that set point range narrows. And so you're more likely to have these symptoms.
And hot flashes are something that we can count and we can put on a chart and we can study. Night sweats, another thing that we can keep track of. There are other things that go along with menopause, or at least are thought to go along with menopause, like the irritability, that are a lot harder to actually quantify. How do you study that?
Well, there are a whole variety kind of emotional symptoms, I guess, if we could call them that, that people have wondered about whether they're associated with menopause or not. And the way one studies those conditions is really, or those situations, you just have to have people fill out questionnaires, ask them questions. There aren't any biological tests. So what we found in Swan is that there is an increase in irritability that may then diminish once you're past the transition. And we've also found that although most women sail through menopause transition with no problems at all, that there is an increased risk for depressive symptoms and for major depressive disorder.
Okay.
On the order of about twofold increase.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about menopause this hour. My guests are Dr. Susan Johnson, an OBGYN, an investigator in the study of women's health across the nation, and Judith Hauck, author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about menopause. We've talked a lot about the history of how we think about menopause and a little bit about how it evolved in human beings. You're also welcome to join our conversation. Now we're talking about modern coping mechanisms for menopause and what we know about menopause today. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 with your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Dr. Susan Johnson. She's an OBGYN and investigator in the study of women's health across the nation. And Judith Hauck is here. She's author of Hot and Bothered: Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. And Susan, let's talk again about, we've talked a little bit about the different symptoms that women can experience when they're going through menopause and how, of course, there's a very broad spectrum of how many women actually experience these symptoms and to what degree they are difficult to deal with. But when a woman goes to a doctor to say, I'm having a lot of hot flashes, I'm having a lot of night sweats, how does a doctor approach treating those symptoms? We're not treating menopause because, of course, you're going to go through that. But the doctor is actually approaching a treatment to those symptoms?
Yeah, I think that the current well, I can't speak on behalf of all doctors, of course, but I will say that the, I think, prevailing expert view at this point is that each woman who comes should be evaluated individually to assess how, you know, the degree of bother that the symptoms are causing her as a guide to whether symptom, whether therapy is appropriate. So that'll be the woman's call, really. And then it's a matter of identifying any health conditions that may make certain treatments risky, and particularly hormone therapy. And so for most women, of course, hormone therapy at the time of menopause for hot flashes turns out to be relatively safe because most women don't have the conditions that will, you know, be contraindications.
However, how do you know if you have the conditions?
And now I'm not probably going to be able to call up the complete list here. But if you have breast cancer, of course, you shouldn't take estrogen. If you've had a blood clot problem, a pulmonary embolus or a deep vein thrombosis, estrogen is considered to be contraindicated. Those are probably the two big ones. Women who have active coronary heart disease probably shouldn't take estrogen based on what we know. And that's really about it for absolute contraindications that come to mind, at least. Now, lots of women will want to try something other than estrogen, and that is a perfectly reasonable approach. And so those options can be discussed, and then the woman can decide what it is she'd like to do.
Well, and Judith, let me go back to you for a moment. In looking at sort of the modern view of menopause, of course, a hormone replacement therapy is the treatment that people tend to think of first. But have we also gone through a change about how we think about what kinds of treatments menopause should get?
Sure. Well, sort of throughout the 20th and the 21st century, women and their physicians have always had alternatives, whether it's now soy products or black cohosh, but Lydia Pinkham's vegetable tonic in the early 20th century, there have always been alternatives that women themselves have used and that physicians have also advised them to use. So exactly what those alternatives are, those have changed. But the fact that there are alternatives out there, that's been fairly constant.
All right. And yes,
yeah, yeah, I would probably add to that the thing that is different, I think, now in the last 10 or 15 years is there's now a pretty intense interest on the part of scientists supported by the National Institutes of Health to study these alternative therapies to see if we can find evidence about whether they really do work and also what their safety is, so that there are actually most of the common things that people might think about are in study right now. And in
common
many cases,
things like meditation or yoga or breathing exercises, is that the kind
of
thing you're talking about?
Or the herbal options like black cohosh or the other kinds of over-the-counter things like soy. And at this point, some of those studies are currently in progress and we don't have the answers yet. So what we don't have is clear evidence that most of these things really work. The best evidence, as best I can tell, is for soy. For the others, it's the quality of evidence is just not good enough to make a definitive statement.
All right. Well, and expand a little bit on the best evidence is for soy, and in what way are you talking about?
Well, so I can refer to there's an organization of healthcare practitioners who are interested in menopause called the North American Menopause Society. And really most of the experts that I know are part of this organization, and they put out position papers periodically, and they did that in 2011 for isoflavones and concluded that although there was no more evidence necessary, that based on reviewing hundreds of studies, that there's appears to be a modest effect on menopausal symptoms. Not as great as estrogen, but at least some effect. And that safety, for the most part, seems reasonable. And so this would be the sort of thing that is reasonable for a woman to try.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones now, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Jean is on the line in Fairfield. Hello, Jean.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to bring up to the listeners that there is a distinction in the hormone replacement programs that have to do with what is actually being taken. There's bioidentical hormones. And the studies that were done with the Women's Initiative and where the adverse health risks were coming out, we're using Premarin and the molecules that are in those products. For example, Premarin is derived from pregnant mare's urine, which is a molecule which is not ever going to have been found in a human female. Also, the progesterone that your expert there was talking about was actually a synthetic molecule. Again, not something that's ever been found in the human body. There are natural, identical progesterone products that actually have the identical molecule, so that your body recognizes that it's that it actually is something familiar and it's meant to be in the human body. And I speak from experience because I have. I've been a user of these products under doctor supervision for just about 9 years. I consistently look about 10 years younger than I am. I am well, I'm up there in my age. I usually don't mention it, but I'm in the gym. I'm working out. I've got tremendous body.
Okay, Jean, let me give the doctor an opportunity to give us some insight on this as well. And of course, every individual is different, and there are many other health factors that can go into how old you look and how you age. But let's talk about some of the different hormone replacement therapies that are available, because there are different sources for hormone replacements, right?
Oh, certainly. And the caller is correct about the composition of Premarin. But of course, there are many other FDA-approved hormone preparations which do contain so-called bioidentical hormones in them, estradiol in particular, and so-called natural progesterone. So these are available through regular, through FDA-approved processes. It's very appealing to think that hormones that are molecules that are the same as what our bodies produce during the so-called reproductive years would somehow be safer or better. The problem is there simply isn't any data. There's no evidence to support those theories. So the concerns about the bioidentical hormones that are obtained from compounding pharmacies, not under direct FDA supervision, the concern there is that one can't necessarily be certain about whether the dosing is consistent from dose to dose. And there certainly isn't any – there is just isn't any evidence that these hormones are safer. So there is a way to get bioidentical hormones through a healthcare practitioner who writes a prescription for. So if that's your preference for reasons that I understand, I personally would prefer people go through that route. But the bottom line is that the FDA, the North American Menopause Society, and other experts all conclude that there simply isn't evidence to say that these are superior.
Okay. Sandy's on the line next from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I had a problems and had a hysterectomy in 2006, okay? It wasn't 3 months later, and I had A1Cs all my life because my father was diabetic. I was on insulin 3 months later. Now, I know all those things are in your brain next to each other. Because I didn't have hormones or because I didn't have... and I begged for them to keep me an ovary. Does that have anything to do with it?
Well, I'll just be honest. It's awfully hard to answer your question about you, because there are so many different, as you know, there are so many different factors that go into someone's risk for developing diabetes. So
right.
I can say from our study, the SWAN study, that there does seem to be an effect of natural menopause on likelihood of sort of developing what's called metabolic syndrome, which is an early set of changes that can increase the risk for actual diabetes. But I just think it would be awfully hard. Your situation sounds pretty dramatic, and I don't actually know of any evidence to link having ovaries removed with the immediate onset of diabetes. And that's really about all I can say. And whether hormones would have prevented it, I would have no way of knowing that.
Oh, Sandy, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry it's difficult to answer that question. Mm. Let's go next to Millie in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Millie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a hysterectomy back in 2008, and with the hot flashes and everything coming on, I was prescribed a Clymera patch, and I'd like to know what they think about that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Sure. So the Clymera patch is estrogen, and is just administered in a different way. Some people would argue that administering it through a skin patch may actually be a safer way to do it than taking a pill, because when you take it by skin patch, it's directly absorbed into the bloodstream and doesn't go into the liver, where some things can happen that may, not be so good. So there's not a consensus that you should always use skin patches, but I would say that this is a perfectly acceptable, maybe slightly better way of taking estrogen. So you should be happy about that.
I'm getting the impression that there are so many options. It sounds like it would be a bit confusing.
Yeah, there are lots of different ways to be given estrogen, pills, patches, vaginal rings. And so there's the actual, you know, evidence about safety among these different methods when you're talking about treating hot flashes early in the postmenopause, there's really not a lot of evidence that there's a dramatic difference in safety. So it does boil down to what a woman feels most comfortable using, I think, for most of us.
How, as a woman, how do you find your way through all of these choices and make decisions based on good information?
If we're just talking about the decision whether or not to take estrogen, regardless of how what form it's given in, I think you go with your own personal sort of feeling. Do I want to take it or not? Because nobody's going to force you to take it. And if you have other sort of non-hormone options that you want to try, you should definitely go for it. But if it's at a point where they just aren't helping, then it's the decision about what kind of estrogen to take. And I really think as long as you're dealing with approved products – because the safety once your doctor and you have talked or your provider have talked about any safety issues with different kinds, you really want to pick the one that you feel most comfortable taking. Maybe you prefer to take a pill. Maybe the idea of the vaginal ring that you only have to replace every 3 weeks seems good to you. Maybe the patch. Not everybody likes the patch or tolerates it well. So I think you go with personal preference at that point.
But I think you raise a really important question about how do you get information to know what you want to do? So clearly, if you want something, you and your body know that. But it's very difficult to find sort of there's all sorts of information out there about whether this or that is safe and effective. But it's very hard to sort of adjudicate the claims that get made because there are all kinds of claims that are made that there's no evidence to back them up.
I couldn't agree with Judith more that we're really in the very early stages of understanding what all of the non-hormone things do and their safety and effectiveness. And so there really isn't any good data at this point. So I personally, my philosophy when I was practicing was to go with safety. What do we know about safety? And then if you want to try something, go for it. If you're not sure about safety, not such a good idea.
So this will continue to evolve. Do you have an idea? Do you have a prediction for when we will have some answers about some of these other therapies?
Well, the big NIH-funded study is called Ms. Flash. Isn't that a great name? Ms. Flash. And they are in the midst of several randomized trials right now looking at yoga, omega-3 supplements, and exercise. Those are the studies that are currently going on. And they're going to do a new one looking at another kind of prescription medication. And I'm expecting within the next 2 to 3 years, we should have the results from those studies that are currently in progress.
All right. So over the next 5 to 10 years, we should have a lot more information.
I think so, yes.
All right.
I think so.
Thank you so much for your time today. Dr. Susan Johnson is an OBGYN and an investigator into the study of women's health across the nation. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
And Judith Houck, thank you.
Thank you.
Judith Houck is the author of Hot and Bothered, Women, Medicine, and Menopause in Modern America. She is also Associate Professor of Medical History and the History of Science and Gender and Women's Studies in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And Ben Kiefer is here with me, host of River to River on Today at Noon. What's coming up on the show today?
Hi, Charity. We've had the political oxygen sucked out of Washington the last couple of weeks by the situation in Syria. Now we return to some domestic issues. Guess what? A coming fiscal showdown on the horizon between the Republicans and the Democrats. That'll be our main issue at noon. Thanks, Charity.
All right. That's coming up today at 12. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, Almost Pioneers, the story of an Iowa couple homesteading in Wyoming in 1913. This is Talk of Iowa.